When we think about a plague, we're normally thinking about some sort of virus or a bacteria or, rats infesting our homes and us getting sick from being bitten by those fleas. But rarely do we think about medicine as causing that plague. Over the past couple of decades, doctors have been prescribing opiates like they're candy. Somebody in this country dies from an opiate overdose every 19 minutes. And a lot of times we think about things like heroin or legal street drugs. A lot of people don't know that many heroin addicts started with prescription opiates. In this episode, we're bringing you Chris Bell, the creator of Bigger, Stronger, Faster in the film Prescription Thugs. Chris is not only a documentarian of these issues, he's also a former addict and has lost his brother to this plague. There's also a lot of gems in this episode. We go into Chris's career, how he became a filmmaker, and we get into a lot of things about health and fitness and especially ketosis, which is a subject that I've been interested in for quite a while, between doing the work I do as a trainer and what I think its implications are for the active duty military community and the veteran community. So, without further delay, let's get into this awesome episode, episode number 38 with Chris Bell. This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's a solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason: to live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast. Ladies and gents, thank you very much for tuning in to the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is episode number 38, and we've got a really special guest for you here today. We've got Chris Bell, the creator of Bigger, Faster, Stronger, and Prescription Thugs. And he's here today to talk about a subject that is not only important to the veteran community, but I think is extremely important to our country as a whole. And that is opiate addiction and prescription drugs in general. Chris, you've done so much work in just this area. And I have to say, I'm a huge fan of all your movies. Prescription Thugs.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Bigger, Faster, Stronger. I was a bodybuilder and a powerlifter, and you opened a lot of people's eyes on these issues. How did you get into all this? I know that's a big question, but
sure. It's actually pretty simple. So I always wanted to make films, narrative feature films. And I actually, like, right around, say, in high school, I was always like the class clown. I was always like messing around and getting in trouble as a senior prank. We stole 100 lawn ornaments, like gnomes off of people's lawns, and put them all around the school and stuff like that. There was always just something ridiculous going on, and I was just always into like entertaining people and being funny, like trying to be funny or trying to be a smart ass or whatever. And so in high school I took a communications class, and I actually ended up getting kicked out of that class for a pretty funny reason. One of my friends tucked his penis between his legs. They told us to take a picture of something shocking. So my friend tucked his dick between his legs, and I took a picture of it, and they thought it was really a girl. It was like underage. So they're like, "Oh my God, I can't believe." We're like, "No, I swear to God, it's Mike Raza, and he has his dick between his legs." Like that in the principal's office and stuff was like crazy, right? So I was just always like that kid or that guy that was just kind of like lighthearted, having fun. And I never thought I could like would turn it into like any money or anything. I just was, you know, didn't really have any sort of clear path. But my father gave me a clear path one day when he said, "You have two choices. Either you can go get a job working for the city, being like a post office worker or like a garbage man, or you can go to community college because your grades suck and you'll never get in anywhere good." And so I had about a 68%, you know, GPA or whatever. In New York State, they don't do like 4.0 and whatever they do, like percentage, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was like at the lower end of my class. It was like 500 kids in my graduating class, and I was at like rock bottom, you know. So I didn't think I really had much of a future, so I went to the community college because that seemed easier than getting a real job. And the real job seemed boring. And I never thought I was like destined to just have like a normal job. So I went to the community college and I found, you know, this class, communications. I took that and I really excelled at it immediately. We had to shoot videos and stuff for it. And so I became really tight with the teacher. Right away, the teacher saw that there was like something different about me. And he was like, you know, took me aside very early on and basically said, "You don't belong here. You know, you belong at like somewhere big." And no one really ever believed it. I would tell people like, "Oh yeah, like, I don't know why he told me this, but you know, he thinks I'm really talented at this," or whatever. And it didn't really manifest itself until I made a music video for a friend of mine and it won a national contest. And I was flown to California and realized the contest was actually judged by Francis Ford Coppola, Kathleen Kennedy, who's Spielberg's producer, and a lot of other like really famous people. And I was like, "Oh shit, I guess I'm pretty good at this." You know, and so that's what really sparked me getting into filmmaking and going. I went to USC Film School. So that's sort of like the long roundabout story. But what happened like to get into USC Film School was kind of crazy. Was I was at a community college where no one's ever transferred to USC Film School from my community college, but I had the backing of all those, you know, celebrities that were willing to like write me letters of recommendation to go to USC. So I had like a letter of recommendation from Francis Ford Coppola, who I've never met, but he saw my work. So I got pretty lucky, you know, got into the program at USC and kind of took off from there. But like, even after I graduated from school, it was still like 8 years before I made, you know, or more than that, like 10 years before I made a movie, you know?
Did you know you were going to do documentaries at the time, or were you going to do something else?
No, I graduated USC in 97. I started Bigger, Stronger, Faster in like 2004. What happened was I had this short film that's online somewhere called Billy Jones. Billy Jones was like an epic short film that I thought was just going to launch my career into the stratosphere. It was about a kid that smokes himself to death to win a prize from his favorite tobacco company. And it was a scripted, you know, dark comedy. Mm-hmm. And it did really well. It won the Yahoo Film Festival, which is like the first and only time Yahoo ever did it, but it was a big deal at the time. Roger Ebert was the one that handed me the award when I won. And, you know, for me, that was like, at the time, it was a huge deal. I got to meet Quentin Tarantino. He was at, you know, he was at this event for it and stuff like that. So it's just all like really exciting when you're young, you know, you're all fired up and you think you're off to the races. But even after like winning that festival, doing that short film, which is a scripted thing, I had a script that I went out around town with, and just, you know, month after month, I just kept hearing like, "Sorry, we're not interested." Like, people would be very interested in the script, but then like it would, you know, the interest would just start to wane as like they start buying other scripts or they read something new or whatever. And so the whole business is kind of crazy. So I just floundered around for like 10 years trying to make, you know, a scripted movie. And it didn't work. So one day I was working at Gold's Gym, and one of my best friends from film school, his name is Alex Bono, he walked in the door to get a membership at Gold's. And I was like, "What are you doing here?" And he's like, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I'm working, you know, I'm selling memberships." He's like, "Why are you selling memberships, dude? You're way too talented to be doing that." And I'm like, "Well, I want to make movies, but it's just not happening." And we got talking, and he's like, "Why don't you write what you know, make a movie about this place?" I'm like, "I want to, but I don't know how," kind of thing. And that's how it started, you know?
Yeah. It seems to me though that, you know, just being there at Gold's Gym and being in that position, it also sets you up for a lot of stuff.
Gold's Gym is the mecca of bodybuilding. You know, today, I just was talking to Josh Brolin this morning, who's amazing, by the way. What a nice dude, but he's playing Cable in the new Deadpool, and he's talking about, like, I got 11 weeks, bro, to put on, pack on some weight, and it's just such a cool environment, like, where, like, not saying that to brag, but I'm just saying, like, how cool is that at your gym, you know, like, and it's, like, every day there's some, you know, Magic Johnson training there, or, like, 50 Cent training there. It's just, what a great fired-up environment it is at the Mecca.
No, absolutely. You know, I grew up in, I'm an East Coast boy too. I'm from Connecticut. I grew up out there. And when I was in the Marine Corps, I used to tell myself, I'm going to move out there to California and I'm going to lift weights and live by the beach. And so I ended up out here just because I went to grad school in Santa Barbara, which is beautiful. But
yeah, Santa Barbara's nice, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But when I moved down to LA, because I actually opened up a gym called the Metroflex Gym in Long Beach. And
I was just at Metroflex. My girlfriend just competed there.
Yeah, my buddy Eddie, he still owns the place. We started it together, but at the time I was poor as fuck. So didn't have a lot of money.
That became a very popular gym. You should be proud of that. That's cool.
I'm extremely proud of it. I think of it as one of the legacies here. But
that's like CT Fletcher. That was like his home gym where he started.
Yep. I used to be his nutrition coach. I was his nutrition coach and Mike.
What a great guy too. I can't say enough good things about CT. He's a cool guy.
Yeah, he's amazing. And you know, funny story about him. He literally walked into the gym off the street one day while he was walking to work. And he literally came from nothing.
I know. Yeah.
I'm just so happy for everything that's happened for him and for Mike and a lot of other people who went through there. But it's an amazing scene down here in Southern California.
It's good if you're positive. You know, like you can also go the other way and be negative. There's a lot of people out there that are like, oh, CT, this and that. Like they get, you know, like people talk trash. Like I always hear people talking trash on like Cali Muscle or this guy. And that guy, you know, I'm always like, why don't you embrace these people? These are people in our industry. I love all of them because I think everybody's unique in their own way. You know, I think everybody's just out there hustling and doing good things. So I always try to keep a positive attitude with all these guys because I think that the fitness industry needs more of that and less of, like people want to fight Rich Piana. Like Rich Piana's a great guy. He's so nice.
Yeah.
People want to fight, you know, people want to show up at a event and fight him. It's just dumb.
He's like one of the nicest dudes I've ever met in my life. And
super nice, super respectful. You know, so it's like, I just try to never say, I've learned my lesson. And now I'd like to say, I try to never say anything bad about anybody unless they really deserve it. You know?
Yep. Absolutely.
I'll call you out if you lie or whatever, but you know,
No, those are good. Those are definitely good words to live by. So getting into, probably want to start with bigger, stronger, faster, or bigger, faster, stronger. Sorry, I always screw up the words.
It's bigger, stronger, faster.
Bigger, stronger, faster.
BSF. So, and actually, I'll give you a little tidbit and aside. A lot of people say, I did this program called Bigger, Faster, Stronger in high school. Yeah,
I remember that. I do remember that.
And I say, look, I know. I actually was trying to call the movie Bigger, Faster, Stronger, but the guy who owns Bigger, Faster, Stronger, the company, is trying to sue me. Now, just so everybody knows, he has no case because one's a movie and one's a business. Mm-hmm. And you can't, like, trademark, you know, like, if the name of your business is Braveheart, you can't say, well, you can't make a movie called that because my business, you know, unless you trademarked it in every corner of the world, you know, every division, you know. I was trying to call it Bigger, Faster, Stronger, and then the guy tried to sue me. So I just rather just to avoid a conflict, I just said screw it. You know?
Yeah, that's a whole other issue, the trademark trolling that goes on with a lot of different things, and that definitely
crazy. Yeah.
Getting into the movie a bit, during that movie, it became pretty apparent that your brother Mike had an issue, and
sure.
With all your films that I've seen, you know, it's literally something that you've lived and that's hit you personally. How bad was it for Mike at the time? And can you get into a little bit of the background as to how he got started on prescription drugs?
Yeah, well, so Mike, he was an interesting guy. He was very moody his whole life. So ever since he was like a little kid, if something happened, it was always extreme. So he loved you just as hard as he would hate you, you know? So, if he struck out in baseball, he'd throw the bat, you know, if you tagged him in hide and seek or something, he'd like throw a temper tantrum so that he could win, you know. He just always was like that, you know, kind of thing, like up and down. I think people like to call that bipolar, but he was never really labeled bipolar until like way later in life, until he was like 35 years old. So I don't even know if he ever was bipolar or not, but he just exhibited like a different mentality, like a lot of just a lot of mood swings and sort of wild actions that, you know, I don't know what the answer for that is, you know, but it was never really diagnosed properly, never treated properly. So when he got to be like high school age, he was always very rebellious. Like he was the first guy to sneak out of the house and, you know, go to the Kiss concert when he wasn't supposed to, when he was only like 12, you know, and he just was always kind of a rebellious kid. So when it came to trying drugs, I think that was a pretty easy thing. He was also the fat kid. And if you know anything about drugs and addiction come from a couple things, lack of connection and also like trauma. So when you're young, you can have several kinds of trauma. They come from your parents or they come from your peers, you know? So Mad Dog was always the fat kid and he was just tormented in school every single day. So what he'd do, he'd come home and he'd beat up his, you know, younger brother because it made him feel good, you know? And that's what happens with these kids. They're conditioned from, you know, school and from other things. And I feel bad because, like, you know, you don't know that that's what's going on, or you don't know the extent of what you're doing when you're young and you're making fun of somebody. But, you know, when you get older, you do realize it. You realize, like, how important it is to treat people good when you're young and when you're kids. But for Mike, we knew very young that he had issues, but it didn't become a drug issue until he was a little bit older. And then when he was about, like, 18 or 19, he had some problems with his girlfriend after he came home from University of Cincinnati, and he was put on a drug called Paxil. And very soon after he was put on Paxil, he tried to kill himself like 3 times.
Oh man.
And that was just like right after he was put on that drug. And I know a lot of vets get put on that drug and a lot of people get put on it for depression. I just don't think it's just jump right into that. You know, I wouldn't say, but I definitely would say be careful, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's just being given out like crazy. And
that's the problem I have with it. You know, I went on Joe Rogan and I said, like, basically, like, psych meds don't work. There's no real proof that they work. And there really isn't actual scientific proof that they actually work. We know anecdotally in a lot of patients, they say, hey, this makes me feel better, whatever. But, like, the scientific data is really hard to prove because there's no markers for mental health. What I feel now a little bit differently, because I had like sort of a backlash from that, I just like to say, like, just be careful with them, you know. Question your doctor rather than saying, ask my doctor if this is right for me. Ask my doctor, what's this going to do to me? What does this actually do? You know, what, how is it going to affect me? So rather than tell people, like, not take stuff, I just say ask questions, and it's up to you, you know. Because when I say tell people not to take stuff because I know it's bad for you, they don't listen. They just get mad at me. So now I just warn them, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's super important, especially when we're talking about something like the veteran population, because you come back and, you know, you're dealing with a lot of different things, and you know, we sure get into why that might be. One of the big things that we've noticed over here in a lot of the guests we've had on the show, from talking to guys like Dr. Mark Gordon, who we talked about before we hit record here, who are doing work with traumatic brain injury, is we're finding that a lot of the guys coming home, they've experienced some sort of low-level traumatic brain injury, whether it be from just being in close proximity to an explosion, having your brain shake back and forth inside your head.
Yeah, I would imagine that's very, very common.
Yeah. I mean, it literally can cause inflammation that can shut down most of the hormones in your body, which – as you know from being experienced with talking to people about hormones, that can cause a lot of medical issues that look a lot like depression,
sure,
a lot like PTS, and a lot like some of the other issues that we're seeing veterans experience.
Exactly. And then when you're depressed and you get on these drugs, right, what they think, this is sort of a theory, but they think that people that are really super depressed, they can't get out of bed depressed, and they get on these drugs, a lot of times they commit suicide because they feel just good enough to commit suicide. And that's just really, really sad, because, like, how do you even know if that's what the reaction's to be. You know, so with psych meds, you're definitely playing with some very, you know, touchy stuff. You know, where you're like, I just try to say, like, I wouldn't mess with it unless it's like a last resort, you know. And for a lot of you guys, I'm sure that decision's like a lot different than me sitting in a chair, you know, here, like, not experiencing what you've experienced. So I don't even want to really comment on that, because I know there's a lot of people in the military that they have to take psych meds because of what they experience, and they work for them. So I don't want to, like, put that down. I just want to say that I do think that they are overprescribed, and they can be very dangerous, you know.
What do you think is the most surprising thing that you've come across as far as, you know, your work with prescription thugs and in your
work? You know what's weird is all the people that I thought weren't on drugs are on the most drugs ever, like housewives, military veterans, athletes. Like, it's all the people that I thought, like, growing up weren't the people that did drugs, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I realized, like, oh, but these are prescription drugs. So these are handed out like candy among housewives, military, athletes, you know, because there's close proximity to doctors in a lot of those cases. So, you know, a lot of pills are flying around this country. And I was just really shocked at the sheer amount of pills. And I was shocked when you hear things like the states of like Tennessee and Vermont and West Virginia and all these different, I think there's 6 states in the United States that have more prescriptions for opiates written than they have people.
That's crazy. We were looking at some statistics earlier today, me and Andrew, and just a few different things here. Since 1999, the amount of prescription opioids sold in the U.S. nearly quadrupled. Deaths from prescription opioids, drugs like oxycodone, hydrocodone, and methadone, have more than quadrupled since 1999. Yet there has not been an overall change in the amount of pain that Americans report. So that means that people they're getting prescribed these things, but we're experiencing the same amount of pain that we had, you know, back in the day before these things came around. And
exactly. The pain hasn't changed. It's just that the game has changed because now you have increasing amounts of stronger drugs, and that's the issue. You know, I don't think that opiates are the problem. What I think is the problem is the fact of how we prescribe opiates. Opiates are prescribed off-label for chronic pain. And when I say off-label for chronic pain, I mean that they are not a good treatment for chronic pain. They're not supposed to be prescribed for chronic pain. But since a doctor practicing in the United States can pretty much prescribe anything for anything they see fit, as long as they don't really put a label on it, then you know, it's called off-label, and they can do it. So when somebody comes in and say, "Doc, my back is sore," what the doctor should say is, "Here's a prescription for some physical therapy. Here's some Advil, you know, like whatever, and go on your merry way." And that's not, you know, that's not really what happens. Like, because the patient will complain. So I think it's like both faults, like on both sides. It's like the patients want drugs, and the doctors, it's an easy thing for them to give drugs. Now the doctors are doing a little bit better of a job of tightening that down, and hopefully we'll see, you know, less abuse because of that. But, you know, still remains to be seen.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of people dying. In 2015, we had 52,000 drug overdoses in the United States. 52,000 people, you know, could fill up like the Staples Center and Madison Square Garden combined.
That's insane. I read somewhere else. It's like there's one death every 19 minutes, I think, in this country from opiate overdose or something like that.
Yeah. And then there's 22 veterans a day committing suicide. How many of those veterans are on opiates, and how many of those veterans are on prescription medication? Like, I think that if you looked at how many of the people that commit suicide, how many veterans that commit suicide a day, that's a stat to learn, are on prescription medication, find out that number. It's probably damn near 100%.
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, we've had a bunch of different guests, one including Dr. Michael Lewis. And they actually have all a pretty large sample of blood from service members. And they actually took the blood from a lot of the service members who or went back into the blood banks to get the blood from service members who had committed suicide. And, you know, they found that each of them had been deficient in certain neurosteroids, like what we talked about with Dr. Mark Gordon. But, you know, they're all deficient in certain things, deficient in certain nutrients. And, you know, it boggles my mind how doctors are so willing to put a chemical in somebody's body, but not say, hey, you know, you're nutritionally deficient in this, and maybe we can head this off with this here.
I think one thing that, like, also veterans should know, and there's a couple veterans that I'm actually helping with this, if they're experiencing PTSD, there's a lot of things that you can do with your diet that will help, you know, with that kind of stuff. One of the things that we're looking at right now is a ketogenic diet, which is basically a higher fat diet, high fat, low carbohydrate diet, no grains, no sugars, really helps your brain function. And I find a lot of people have less traumatic, you know, episodes of PTSD on a ketogenic diet. It also is responsible for basically killing inflammation. It will completely stop the process of inflammation in your body. So, you know, if you're pre-diabetic, pre-cancer, all those things, it can just reverse that, you know. So we're seeing a lot of medical benefits coming from the use of diet. And actually my next film that I'll probably start shooting, I think in May, is going to be all about nutrition and basically how to eat, because I think that that's one of the most important things. And if I can educate the world on one thing, you know, it's like, hey, don't do drugs and learn how to eat.
Absolutely, dude. You know, you're speaking my own heart. I'm a huge advocate for the ketogenic diet. I talk about it quite a bit on the Warrior Soul Goji. And, you know, I suffer from a disease called ulcerative colitis, which is the symptoms largely come about because of inflammation. And it is literally the only thing that's ever really helped me with it. The medication that they've given me for it has definitely not helped as much as my diet has. And in fact, in some cases, it's actually hurt me. I had a prednisone withdrawal not too long ago where the doctor didn't.
And so do you do a ketogenic diet now, or do you follow it like kind of close, like, you know, do you follow it a little bit now, or?
Oh yeah. I'm very religious about the ketogenic diet. I've been on 80% fat, 10% protein, under 10% carbs. And I've been doing that for quite a long time now. I've also been...
How long?
I'd say about 4 years. And the thing is, my last... I don't look anything like a bodybuilder now because I've been doing martial arts. But I did the first classic physique competition that was here in the United States in the MPC. I took second, and it was the best I ever looked. I was only eating two meals a day. I was living off of 80 grams of protein a day.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? You probably weren't even hungry, right?
Yeah, dude. And that was the thing. Like, when I first started it, I didn't quite understand what I was doing. And I was afraid to talk about it because, you know,
that's the thing is, like, people just need to do it, and you need to do it for 3 months. Absolutely. After 3 months, you know, all of a sudden you're like, it's like, it's like everything starts working better, right? All the digestion problems, anything that you had starting out, the keto flu, like all the bullshit goes away. And all of a sudden you're in like this zone where you're like, I hate carbs. Like, I don't need carbs.
Yep.
They slow you down. They get in your way. You don't even look forward to cheating. You look at cheating like with disdain, like, oh, I got to go out to dinner with these fat fucks, you know?
Absolutely.
And, you know, I lost 20 pounds when I just started doing it again. And the 20 pounds that I lost, though, it's like all body fat. You know, it's like it's 20 solid good. Like, I look way different right now from, you know, especially from prescription thugs, because I was like, you know, 250 pounds of that. But right now I weigh about 185.
Dude, it's seriously amazing because, I remember back in the day when I was eating like eight meals a day and, you know, living off of chicken breast and things like that.
And
I remember
starving,
the brain fog,
right?
I had and I was so sick because I
can't
even
like
starving, out of breath,
right? And you're like, you can't even I couldn't even get like when I was on a bodybuilding diet, I tried it for a couple weeks and I couldn't even get to like open the Tupperware. I'd be so hungry I wanted to just bite my fingers off. And it was only like I just ate 2 hours ago, you know? And so I was constantly hungry. I was constantly cooking. And with what I do, like, I just like to be free. And so what I felt when I went on a ketogenic diet is actually freedom from food, freedom from spending a lot of money on food, because that was my number one thing I spent money on, you know? So I'd rather spend money on like good food, you know,
exactly,
and get less of it because I need less of it, you know, and stuff like that. So I think like with the veterans, they should learn about stuff like that. They also should learn about some alternatives to some of these drugs. And one of the alternatives, it just happens to work out perfect because I'm doing a movie about it. One of the alternatives and one of the things I've been talking about a lot lately is kratom or kratom. Mm-hmm. And you may have heard of that, spelled K-R-A-T-O-M. That's a plant that's in the coffee family. And it works like opiate painkillers, but it is not an opiate painkiller. It's not let's say if it's addictive, it's about as addictive as coffee. The withdrawals from it are very, very mild. You wouldn't even feel them. But it works. It actually helps people detox off of opiates. And at certain doses, it actually works like opiates to kill pain as well.
Wow. So I've heard a bit about this. And, you know, I know that you are working on a film on it.
Sure. If people want to hear more information, if you just Google like Chris Bell, Joe Rogan, you'll see one of the episodes I did with of Joe Rogan's podcast. It's like an hour and a half long of just us talking about kratom. So that has like a ton of information on it. And I have a friend that owns a kratom company, and it's the only one that I recommend because there's a problem with the regulation of kratom. And we can talk about that in a minute. But his company is naturalorganics.com is the website with an X. Awesome. Naturalorganics.com.
Naturalorganics.com. I'll make sure all this stuff's in the show notes.
Yeah. And so just what I want to say about that is the reason. So the DEA has come in and tried to make kratom a Schedule I drug because it actually works. But the issue really is regulation with it. Like the kratom companies themselves, since it's kind of a new substance, new to America, I should say, it's been around for 2,000 years. Since it's like new to America, everybody's like hustling to make money. Mm-hmm. So there's not a whole lot of regulation in that world yet. And that's kind of the issues that are going on and that we're seeing with this film.
Yeah. So let's get into that a bit, because I know that you yourself, you've experienced a lot of issues with your own addiction. And, you know, you covered that a bit in Prescription Thugs. And I've heard you talk about this before. Kratom is one of the things that's helped you to become sober.
Yeah, it's one of the things that helps me stay sober, I think. But also, I just like to tell people and like warn them that that's only one part of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, when I got sober, I went to AA and I went to a lot of meetings. I put a lot of work into my sobriety. I went to rehab for 90 days. You know, I went to AA after rehab for like 2 years. I haven't been to an AA meeting in about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months. But I go to the gym every day, and that's, you know, that's part of it. But also, like, what I replaced AA with is I actually help people pretty much on a daily basis through like Facebook, Instagram, and whatever, just to stay sober, and that really helps me a lot. So you can't just take kratom. You have to sort of learn the rules of sobriety and play by those a little bit. I wouldn't say you have to adhere to 100% sobriety or that you have to adhere to exactly what they say in AA anyway. But look, if we're trying to get help, we need to speak out help, and we need to be humble, and we need to like go to the people that are going to help us. And AA is a great program for that.
It's definitely true. I mean, you need to work on
yourself.
Probably
one of the best programs in the world as far as like just a cool place to go, especially for people like veterans. And I would really encourage like any veterans that are having any problems with anything. You know, it doesn't matter what it is really. Like if you go into an AA meeting, you don't have to have a problem with drinking. Mm-hmm. You need support. But the thing that's like so cool about AA is I've met so many people, you know, through the program, because everybody's like so inviting and so nice. And I thought I was going to go in there and it was going to judge me and, you know, but it's, everybody's done worse than you. So, you know, it's kind of a place to be open and free and talk about whatever you want. So I just encourage people that, if they're going to try something like kratom to get off of opiates or to deal with their pain, and they still have a tendency to want to go back on pills, like in their head, then they should probably do a little bit of work on their sobriety.
That, I mean, other aspects too. I mean, it probably, if you're healthier, if you're more fit, if you're taking care of your body and things like that, you'll be experiencing less pain. And then, you know, if you, I mean, there's a whole host of other things here too. Like if somebody's had a hormone deficiency, if they haven't had a blood panel drawn, you know, if their pregnenolone isn't pumping or anything like that.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, you know, Dr. Mark Gordon, I mean, it's ridiculous what they do with our, you know, with our soldiers, with our guys, you know, like you guys should all get your blood tested. You should all be on whatever you need to keep your levels, the right spots and everything, you know, like nobody's doing any of that stuff. And it's not, you know, it's, that stuff goes a long way in our health and in preserving us and keeping us around for a long time and keeping us healthy. And I think that it's the wave of the future. You know, I think this preventative medicine, this anti-aging stuff's going to be something that's taken a lot more seriously pretty soon.
Definitely. And I think that, you know, with the amount of the impact sports that people are doing and you know, the popularity of MMA, I think that's going to bring a lot of light to it. You know,
MMA is, it's crazy how they're like, you know, people are like, well, it's not as bad as boxing and it's blah, blah, right? They don't know yet because it's new, right? So yeah. They don't really know, how bad it's going to be. And I would just hold off on making any comments about how bad it is, but I've seen some pretty bad MMA fights. One thing that I love MMA, it's my favorite sport by far. I like it better than football, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's awesome to watch, but I feel like some of these fights, like, so in my heart as a fan, I want to see it go. But some of them, like, man, that was like a couple too many punches.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I've seen dudes recover from the worst knockouts ever, and they just get right back up. So I was like, well, I wouldn't be a good referee because I would call it all the time. But, you know, I think we might be a little bit better off, a little safer calling it sooner. But, you know, that's just me. Well, you know, they also have millions of dollars on the line and people's livelihoods on the line. Like somebody gets one loss in the UFC, it could affect their entire career, you know?
That's one of the things I wanted to mention here. And I definitely want to get back into Kratom and where to find it and the issues about regulation in a second. But I've heard you talk about your brother before, and you said that one of the turning points was when he took a blow to the head during a wrestling match.
He was wrestling a guy. If you look, go on the internet and go on YouTube, he was wrestling a guy named Perry Saturn. And actually, you know, I was watching something the other day on the internet about Perry Saturn. He's broke right now. So my brother's dead, right? Mm-hmm. Perry Saturn threw my brother out of the ring, and my brother landed on his head and basically cracked his skull. He had arthritis in his neck ever since then. He was never the same mentally. And, you know, people wanted to send me that video, like as if I would be happy to see that Perry Saturn is broke and, you know, all drugged out now. And to me, it made me cry. Because I just thought, like, man, like, this guy, he didn't learn, you know? It's like, when you do something like that to somebody, and you get, like, he's already had his comeuppance 1,000 times, and he still hasn't learned, you know? So when I see these, like, old wrestlers and the thing, these people, like, still trying to hang, like, that's my brother's problem. He didn't give up on wrestling when wrestling gave up on him. You know, it was time for him to go and do other things with his life. He was only 37, but he wasn't making it in wrestling where he wanted to make it. And so, you know, but I was just saying, like with the Perry Saturn thing, I think people thought, I would think it was cool to see him broken down and beaten. It's like, I just don't even have that in my heart to like think that way about people. I thought I would, but then when I saw him, I'm like, this is really sad. This sucks that he's like this, you know? And all that stuff could be avoided. It's all drugs and alcohol. But, you know, for my brother, getting thrown on his head definitely was it was like a turning point. He already had these tendencies, these mood swings and stuff like that. And that was just another turning point that made him worse. It made him do more drugs. I think the main thing with that was he was humiliated. He would always say that he was going to kill Perry Saturn. He was going to hunt him down and find him. You know, he's not going to know when it's coming. He would, like, plot all these revenge things. And I'd be like, you know, who cares? Don't be so angry at him, whatever. It was like, he did it on purpose. You know, he threw my brother out of the ring on purpose. And that's why he was so mad about it. But I think that, you know, when we get to the end of all this research on traumatic brain injuries and everything, we're going to find out that a lot of it, you know, the reason why all these guys are dying young, whether it's like my brother or like, you know, Aaron Hernandez, a lot of this stuff is going to have to do with a lot of blows to the head.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and you know, you hear Dr. Gordon talking about it. They found issues with traumatic brain injury in a lot of the serial killers that exist out there, a lot of the violent crimes. There's so much going on, but you know, the stem root is probably hormone deficiency, and it's interesting.
Sure. And then another way to fix those damaged brains, another way to fix TBIs is with a ketogenic diet. So like, yeah. you know, it all keeps coming back around to the same couple things, you know?
Yeah. Reducing that inflammation, getting it out of there and everything. Getting back into the kratom issue. So they want to schedule this supplement, this plant. You know, I don't necessarily want to call it a drug right now, but they want to schedule this thing. And, Have you gotten any good reasons for why they want to schedule it?
Yeah, it was an increase in poison control calls. So it went from like 2 up to like 600 in a couple of years. And that's actually like, you know, I think like 10,000 people call a year because they ate laundry pods. You know, like more people call the emergency room for having things stuck up their ass than for kratom.
My girlfriend works in an emergency room. She can attest to that.
Yeah. So you know, like to say that kratom is a national health crisis, it's like, well, are dildos? I mean, you know, it's like that's basically how dumb it is. So basically, that was the thing. Is like they're saying it's a health crisis, but you know how everything is. There's a reason. There's money behind it. There's pharmaceutical lobbies that don't want to see this. You know. They don't want to see this out there because it takes away from drugs like Suboxone or, you know, rehab centers that don't want people using this because, like I said, if you're a real hardcore sobriety, you know, AA person or something like that, they hate things like this because what they do is they go, people are going to take that and then they're going to just go back to their old ways, and, you know, and they think that their way is the only way. So there's a lot of people that are definitely against kratom. There's a lot of reasons why people would want to see it fail or not make it to the market or stay on the market.
Right.
Also, I think part of it is the fault of the kratom industry itself. A lot of these companies advertise their products like Happy Kratom or Rainbow Kratom or like, you know, trying to insinuate that you're going to get high off of it. And for me, that's not really the case. I have talked to people in the movie that say they do get high off of it. I haven't really felt high off of it, but I definitely have felt like an elevated mood. I haven't felt like stony high off of it, but maybe it's a different feel or whatever. I don't know what high even means really. So it's hard to tell, you know, but it's definitely not something that you take and it impairs your driving or it would, you know, do anything where you'll know that you took it, but you're not going to be out of control.
Yeah, you know, that's pretty funny to me because, you know, you go into the grocery store and you find poppy seeds. Now, I know there's a lot of people at home that might not think that you can make a drug out of poppy seeds that you get for baking. But back when I was having an issue with opiates, I got to that point where I literally would make like sort of tea with poppy seeds. And that put me on my ass. Like more than almost any other opiate ever had before in life. And, you know, I was reading up on it and kids have actually died from making poppy seed tea.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I
just thought that you can't get high from eating them. Right. But it's something with like, they have to be heated.
I don't want to say exactly what I did to them.
Yeah. You don't want to put that information out there.
But it's very simple. And it doesn't require any heating or anything like that.
The reason why at first I thought kratom didn't do anything was because I thought it was supposed to make you high, and it didn't make you high. I was like, well, that's worthless. But then when I realized, like, oh, it actually kills pain, it actually works. That's when I got excited about it. That's when I was like, okay, this is something that I need to look into more. What happened was I wanted to make this. You know, I was using this product And I wanted to make a documentary about it just to sort of let more people know about it. And it was going to be sort of a small little thing. And then all of a sudden, the DEA announced they were going to make it a Schedule I drug. So I'm like, oh, let's make a documentary about this. And so we've just been putting that together for the past couple months, you know?
Wow. And what kind of things have you found while filming the documentary? I know you're trying to talk to a lot of people who've been against it, trying to get their perspectives, which has been an awesome
sure.
part of
it. Yeah. What I found was like a couple things. Like, first of all, I found that not everything is as clear cut as it seems. When I first started this project, I was like, screw the government, screw these people trying to take, you know, these things away from us. We deserve this and blah. And then I started looking into it and I realized like, oh, well, the kratom, the industry itself isn't really regulated. You don't really know what's in there. Like, they don't really, these companies aren't really testing it. It only costs a little bit of money to test it and find out that there's no mold or bacteria in it. Don't you think that you should do that? You know, and kind of things like that, that I was finding out along the way, where you find out like, okay, so everything's not just cut and dry. It's not just like the poison control numbers went up. It's the poison control numbers went up, but also a lot of people are making a lot of money off of this. Mm-hmm. And the government wants to make sure that it's vouched for, regulated, and sold the proper way, just like all the other supplements that are being sold. But a big part of it really, if you distill it all down and you say follow the money, it's that other supplement companies that are making and putting out products on the market and are part of lobby groups, they don't want a supplement to be on the market that doesn't have to go through the same protocol they do. Mm-hmm. Because that's unfair. You know, they're like, well, hey, we got, it's about $4,500 per batch to test the supplements. So if you have a supplement that's going out in, you know, like, I don't know how much it is, but it's like per, you know, per half ton or something, you got to spend $4,500 to test that batch, you know? And so like, that's the thing, is like, that's where people are skimping out on kratom. So they're not testing it for mold, bacteria, salmonella, yeast. And you would think that that stuff is important. That's why this, I said the brand that I use, Urban Ice from Natural Organics, they are the ones that they test all their product. And they're like the only ones that I know that definitely test everything that comes through there.
Wow. And how did you find out about it? What was your first experience?
I met this guy named Kelly Dunn, and Kelly owns that company, Urban Ice. Mm-hmm. So I met Kelly and we were talking about opiates, and he was like, I was a bad opiate addict. And I'm like, oh, what happened? And we started talking. And then, while we were rapping, he told me like, you know, I used to be hooked on opiates. And I'm like, yeah, so was I. I'm like, how did you get off of them? And he said, I used kratom. And I was like, huh? And so he started telling me about, you know, his story and everything. And he had seen Prescription Thugs. And that's sort of how we met in the first place, was he had seen Prescription Thugs. And he was a friend of a friend. And he wanted to meet me. So we met and we started talking about opiates. And he told me that he had gotten off of opiates with kratom. And it was just kind of like one of those perfect storms, like meeting the right guy at the right time. And I used the product and I actually loved it. I was like, this is something I think is great. I think, you know, that's why I want like veterans to know about it. You know, I think that for your community, it's really important to know how to get out of pain.
Absolutely.
And also the other thing with kratom, I should say, is like, to me, it's like the ultimate antidepressant, like the ultimate. I have a friend who's a cop, and you know, a lot of cops are a little bit bitter, a little bit pissed off, you know, mm-hmm. a little bit chip on their shoulder sometimes, yeah. Not all of them, but a lot of them, because they, you know, they deal with a lot of shit. So my buddy, he took kratom the other day and he was like, I don't want to take it when I go to work, because like, you know, I wouldn't want to be on something and whatever. And then like a couple days later, he's like, now I take it every day for work because it helps me deal with people, you know, mm-hmm. it helps me smile, you yeah. know? And I think that that's interesting. Like, I've talked to people who are severely, severely depressed. A friend of mine was an addict, like heroin addict, and he's been severely depressed lately. And, you know, he told me, like, hey, I take kratom, and I'm, like, walking on the street, smiling at people, waving to my neighbors. He's like, is that normal? And I'm like, yeah, it's normal to be nice to people. We just forget about it because we're always in pain. You know, and I think you know, Vince Lombardi, he has this quote, fatigue makes cowards of us all. And it's the same thing with pain. Like when you're in pain, you can't be nice to somebody, you know, like you're in pain. So you take everything out on everybody else. And I just think the less that we're in pain, the more we can focus on ourselves, getting better, the more we can help other people as well. And the other thing that I have been using a lot to get out of pain lately is CBD oil, which I think is another thing that's a Schedule One drug that's ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, that's definitely ridiculous. And I just got my cannabis card not long ago, and it's helped me so
much.
Where
do you live now?
What was that?
Where are you located?
I'm in Redlands, about 60 miles east of you, I think.
Yeah, okay. So out here in California now, it's recreational, I guess, right?
Yeah, 2 years. 2018, it's going to be recreational. You still can't get it recreationally. And if you go into the dispensaries, you're not going to be able to go in there unless you have a rec. But after 2018, they're setting it up for that. I would still recommend trying to get your cannabis card if you do want to use it, because if you do have an ailment, because it's going to be taxed, you know. And right now, if it is considered medication, it's not going to be taxed. But
yeah, that's such a weird thing is like with prescription drugs and everything, like the whole tax issue with it. It's like, it's marijuana, so people are like, yeah, man, make it legal and tax the shit out of it. And you're like, yeah, but that's not fair because you're not doing that to Oxycontin, you know?
Well, and that's the thing.
You should look at that.
I think there's this like moral aversion that people have from people taking something to make them better, which you covered in bigger, stronger, faster, and making them feel good.
Big problem with getting high.
Yeah, I don't get that.
People hate it.
Yeah,
I know. We should be living in a society where, like, it should be, you know, if somebody's like, if somebody's happy, why should we look down upon that? You know what I mean? Like, if somebody's like, oh, I'm going to get high, that's great. But if they're going to get high on meth and go steal a VCR, it doesn't make me happy. But like, I just think marijuana has been so poorly, like, singled out, and obviously that's cliche to say because everybody says that, but like it's just the worst thing to pick. Like, it was the worst thing to pick to ban on anything they could have picked back in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean,
alcohol is just completely useless.
It's completely useless. Completely useless. I've made more poor decisions on alcohol than anything.
I was an alcoholic for years. I was struggling with alcohol dependency, and anybody out there struggling with alcohol should also know that Kratom helps a lot of people to stop drinking. So if you're having a problem and you can't stop drinking, also, if you guys are vets and you can't afford to get Kratom, I understand that. And if you'd like to try it, you can email me. And, you know, we're going to go on the honor system here. I trust you guys. You guys can email me at biggerstrongerfaster@me.com, and I'll send you a bunch of samples. I have a hookup with that company, and if you can't afford it, I'll send you a bunch of samples and you can try. Or if you just want to see, if it works for you, you know, then I'll send you out some.
Awesome.
And you can try it out, because a lot of times people don't have access, and a lot of times what I hear from the vets is like, yeah, sounds good and all, bro, but I'm broke, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a vet, I'm broke, and I'm like, I get it. So I just say, you know what, hit me up.
Yeah, I'll definitely include that there in the show notes. I think, as far as looking at what this drug does and how it helps people, are there any addictive properties to it? Like, can you get addicted to this?
Yeah, sure. There's addictive property. Yeah, I think there's addictive properties to Kratom. However, it's what's the level of addiction? You know, that's another thing that people are worried about. Like, oh, it gets you high, and oh, it's addictive. And it's like, well, there's a lot of things in our society that are addictive. There's things that are addictive that we're doing right now. We're talking on the internet. That's addictive.
Right.
You know, there's just so many things that are addictive. It's really hard to put addiction in a box like that and say addiction's bad. Addiction isn't, it's like, it depends on how you define it, but like, also like, to be addicted, like some people are like, oh, I'm addicted to going to the gym, I'm addicted to this. And like, any addiction can be bad because it can have diminishing returns or detrimental side effects. We just have to decide whether or not that addiction is a success. So far, kratom has not demonstrated to be negative to society in any way. And I think that's what's really important. You know, there's not people killing people over it. There's not crime being caused because of it. It's only doing good things and only helping people. And that's a pretty easy way. Even with marijuana, there's negative things to it that can be associated with it. People can say, yeah, it ruined my family. My family spent all their money on it. And even with kratom, we can still have those things. Like I have in my film, the mother of a kid who committed suicide. This poor kid, Ian Motner, was 20 years old, and he jumped off an overpass and killed himself. There's so many unanswered questions in that case that it's really hard to pin it down on kratom, but that's how the mom would like to structure the argument. So, you know, there's a lot of complicated issues that arise out of some of these documentaries and some of this stuff, but we just have to look at it logically and say, is it good or bad for society?
Yeah, and you know, whenever we hear about something like that, you need to know a little bit more about the case too. You know, there's a lot of different things that could have been going on there, especially in a case of suicide.
You know, sure. And there's like anecdotal evidence for a lot of things, but like if, you know, I always say this, like, okay, if you have a one-off story, that's cool. But if you have a one-off story and it happened 30 times, then like maybe we should start looking into it. Maybe it's a trend and more, maybe it's more than, you know, that. But we haven't seen that with kratom. We saw one, like, you know, 5,000 kids committed suicide in 2013 when it happened or whatever the date was. And in that year, only one kid's death was blamed on kratom. The other 4,999 were blamed on something else, you know. So to have a one-off of something doesn't make it absolute, you know.
Exactly. And this stuff comes in pill form, or is it taken any other way?
It's just a ground-up leaf. So it comes in any form from a leaf to, you know, just a ground up powder to a capsule. I take it in veggie caps. I prefer, it tastes gross, you know, so I prefer to take it in veggie caps. And I take it every day. And to tell you the truth, a lot of the veterans, a lot of people I talk to are veterans that take it and they love it because they're used to taking so many other drugs. I'm like, okay, I take this. I don't take my antidepressant. I don't take this. I'm not recommending that anybody get off their pills that their doctor gives them.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that it seems like when we administer kratom to veterans, they prefer it to a lot of the other stuff that they have to take.
And we have to, I just want to mention this too. You're not associated with anybody who sells this stuff or you don't do it as a business or anything.
No, I'm not. No, business-wise, I'm not associated with kratom at all. I just have a friend that's in the business that, like, he likes to offer helping people out. So I feel like that's a good service to offer people.
Cool.
It's like, hey, if you want to try it, you know, here you go. But I don't make any money off of selling it.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that for the people at home, so that they're not like Chris and Chris are gonna make $1,000 off of this or anything. You know,
I'm really just interested in helping people. Yeah. You know, and I've had the opportunity, like, honestly, like, it was, I went on Joe Rogan, and when I went on Joe Rogan's podcast, there was, like, an opportunity for me to get involved with selling, you know, there's so many people that listen to that podcast, and so much comes out of it, so there's definitely, like, a lot of opportunity where people, you know, wanted me to, like, do stuff for, to make money, and I'm like, well, that just sort of blurs the line, then, now you're looking at something, you know, we can't do that, you know?
So, one question, just getting back to your profession, your craft here, when you're starting a film like this and you're trying to cover the issue, where do you start? How do you get started on a project like that? What's your first step?
Well, really, you just, you know, look, you have an issue and you're like, okay, everything has to be a perfect storm, right? So there's gotta be money for it. There's gotta be things, able to fall in place. So like for this particular film, I had a couple guys that I wanted to work with on something. And then I met that guy, Kelly. And then there's like a nonprofit set up to help kratom. And we had some money from that. And it was like, there was everything sort of was coming together and it became an opportunity, you know? So it wasn't like, I want to make a movie about kratom. And then like, it just was like, let's go full blast. It was like a matter of a bunch of circumstances going on. We're like, wow, there's an opportunity here. Let's do this. This would be awesome. You know, this could help a lot of people. And that was the main focus. So starting with the main focus being to help people, we're like, well, how can we start doing this? And it's like, well, let's just get involved as activists. So it's almost like we started as like activists, and we started just filming what was going on and filming the people that were lobbying for it and doing stuff like that. But in general, like when I start a movie, the very first thing that I do personally, if I just come up with an idea, like out of the blue, I write what's called a treatment or an outline. You know, it's basically an outline. I write a treatment for it, and that's anywhere from like 2 to 40 pages. And that's just going to be like an outline of like what this is going to be, you know? So for Kratom, I wrote like a 10-page outline. It's like, hey, this plant, blah, blah. Basically what I told you in the first 5 minutes of this podcast about it. And that's the treatment for it. And I bring that around to investors and bring that around to people that want to work on the film and bring, you know, that's how you sort of, that's how you get support. And that's what it's all about. Being a filmmaker, you have to be like a general. You have to go around and get support from everybody and then take your army into battle, you know? And that's sort of how you make a movie, is you got to basically be like, okay, I got this good idea. Now, a good idea with one person is going to go nowhere.
Absolutely.
You need a good idea, and then you need to tell your friend, like, you got an idea for a podcast, right? And until you went and talked to Andrew, you didn't have a podcast, right? So, like, that, I don't know how you're...
Well, what happened was I rolled out of bed, and I decided I was going to start a podcast that day, and then I went through a tutorial.
Yeah, but you needed somebody, You needed like somebody else to make it happen, or you needed something else to fall in line, or you needed an inspiration, first of all, you know, to do it. And then after that, you need other people to help you make it happen. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if I didn't have the audience that I have, you know, the veteran community that supports Warrior Soul, it's been absolutely amazing for us. And if I didn't have that vision for them and the love for them, I'd probably definitely put it to the side, because, you know, it's difficult work. And that's one of the things I admire about you is
all this stuff. I don't think people realize how hard it is. Like, doing the podcast part of it's easy. Like this part that we're just talking right now, it's like coordinating everything, and everybody's like busy, and it's hard to get in touch with people. And then, you know, it's just like my schedule is just always crazy. And I tell you the truth, like I'm hard to get to commit to anything, because I always want to be working on my own stuff, right? And so sometimes I forget that I have to take time to actually promote the stuff that I do, and also I have to spend time to give back to people and help people that have helped me, or help people like veterans, you know. And so it's sometimes it's hard for me to commit to stuff, or I'll overcommit to stuff and then I feel bad because I can't do it. So what I just try to do now is, like I said, I use it as part of my sobriety. I'm like, I got to help people. So I got to make sure, that I'm around for people, and that I'm available and accessible. You know, it's like, I'm not accessible all the time, but I'm as accessible as I can be, you know?
You know, and that's true even when you're not successful. You know, I was living out of my car a few years ago, and The thing that got me out of it was doing free YouTube videos, giving people fitness advice and things like that. Like, that's literally how I got myself out of living out of my car. And I tell people,
yeah, it's crazy. You know, and it's funny how you can go from so low. Like, people don't understand. Like, I was 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago, as of like 3 days from now, you know, was when I got sober. And so like 3 years ago, I was an absolute mess, like an absolute, you know, and was that I didn't think I was ever going to get out of it. I thought I was going to die that way. So 3 years ago, I thought I was going to be dead. So you talk about like living out of your car, like I know where you were at, you know, and to see where I've come and the amount of stuff that I've done in these 3 years, it's insane. And the amount of confidence I've been able to build back into myself. Like, I'm really proud of myself because I know how hard it was. And for somebody like you, you should know how hard that was, but it's only been 3 years. It seems like that was probably eternity ago for you, right?
I remember that. Probably. It's only a few years ago. And it's one of the things I try to think about a lot, because I always try to remember how fortunate I am now. You know, I look at my house. It's not that big, but it's a castle to me. You know, it's a house.
Exactly. You know, like I live in Venice, California, It's one of the most, I think it was just rated like Marina Del Rey where I live, like one of the most expensive like places in the United States to live. Mm-hmm. It's like, I live here like a dummy, but, you know, it's expensive. So you can't really have a big house here. You can't really have a whole lot of anything here. You know, but it's cool. It's where I like to be. You know, it's like it's my home. I've been in Venice forever, you know? So, but yeah, it's like, but I'm just proud to be back on my feet again, is, you know, what I'm proud of.
What's the one biggest piece of advice you give to somebody who's trying to pull themselves back up and get back after it?
Listen to your heart. You know, I would say just like, listen, you know, basically, I have this video that I tell a lot of people to watch. Well, there's a bunch of videos on the internet, but if you want to pull yourself back together, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, there's a guy, and his name used to be not the Warrior Soul, but the Ultimate Warrior.
Yep.
Jim Helwig, who has passed away. But before he passed away, he left us a legacy of YouTube videos called The Injections of Inspiration. And to me, that was the original part of where I, that was the original point where I decided to get sober. I would watch his videos with just like, just tears would be streaming down my face, and I'd be so intense. I just wanted to, like, you know, punch a hole in the wall. And the reason I was crying wasn't because I was sad. And the reason I was crying, it wasn't tears of joy either. It was like tears of disappointment in myself. Because everything the guy was saying was true, you know? I was a piece of shit. I was a bump on a log. I was like, everything that he was saying in these videos, don't just sit there like this, do this. Don't be like this, do this. And it just filled me with such energy, you know? And so I always tell people, like, find inspiration. And that's one thing I can actually highly recommend is the Ultimate Warrior's Injections of Inspiration. Like, if you have a friend or you yourself are suicidal, go on the internet, look up Ultimate Warrior's Injections of Inspiration, and you'll snap out of it pretty quick. But for me, you know, that it was something like that. And also, people, I think, need to understand depression's very deep. Depression's very real. It's not something that you can't tell your friends to snap out of it. So if your friends are depressed, just be there for them, love them, just know that they need you, you know, and just like, I think that's the most important thing. Be compassionate to other people, and, you know, they'll also be compassionate to you when they see you doing that. But I think, like, in the end, we all need each other. And so if you are suffering or whatever, don't be afraid to reach out for help, and don't be afraid to ask people, because I was just so scared. It's like, I'm going to walk into an AA meeting, they're going to be like, look at this guy, he doesn't even know how to go to AA, you know, like, I didn't know what to think, I didn't know what they were going to say about me, but when you don't care, it's the best thing in the world, it's the best feeling ever, you know, and you just go, just walk through life not caring. It's like such a better, less stressful feeling, you know. So I just try to, like, tell people that, just be, you know, be open to new things, and just do shit. Don't be scared, you know?
How big of a role was physical training for you, recovery?
It's a pretty big role. You know, I think I like training. I like working out. I used to be a power lifter. I have two fake hips, so I don't do much power lifting anymore. But I just started deadlifting again this past week. Past 2 weeks. Making it a point to get in there and do some deadlifts. I have to train lighter because I have a torn rotator cuff, a torn tricep, a bunch of other stuff I need to get fixed. Yeah. So while I'm banged up for now, I'm just kind of going through the motions with my training. What I'm really meticulous with is the diet, which I think is much more important, man. When you're on point with the diet, you're training. You know, I do cardio every day for like an hour. Mm-hmm. That's just something that I've been doing every day. Since I got serious about the ketogenic diet, because you're actually already burning fat it turns into a fat burning machine. And when you do cardio, most of the time you're just burning glucose off, you know, excess glucose. But when you're in ketosis, you're burning fat. All right, it taps into your stored body fat, especially if you're not eating a whole lot of food. And so, it's more efficient to do cardio on a ketogenic diet. So that's why I do cardio every morning for an hour. And then my other training beyond that's like 3 or 4 days of like just lifting weights, you know, but it's very important to me. Not necessarily the physical training or pushing the body. It's more important to me to get to the gym and be around people and, you know, fitness through like community. Like, that's why I love things like CrossFit. A lot of people will like, you know, make fun of CrossFit or whatever, but like CrossFit, powerlifting, things like that, where you can go in and, be like a community. Like even like, you know, bodybuilding, if you go to Gold's Gym, I work out. Gold's Gym is amazing. It's an amazing gym, but bodybuilding is a very selfish sport.
Yeah.
And you don't get a lot of that community. You'll have a couple guys like working out with each other here and there, but like for the most part, like the power lifters will be like 10 of them all lifting together.
Yeah.
You know, Olympic lifters, there's 10 of them. They're all lifting together. Mm-hmm. CrossFitters are all like in a huge group and they're all doing burpees together. You know, and it's like, I like that kind of atmosphere. I think that that's cool. I think it's also conducive to what you guys do in the military, powerlifting or CrossFit, you know, kind of more suited. And you see a lot of guys from the military do CrossFit and do powerlifting, you know?
Yeah, I did powerlifting and bodybuilding. I was a lot more attracted to powerlifting because of that group aspect and having people root you on during your training. And
bodybuilding is really cool, but it's really interesting and fascinating. But it's so hard to say, you look great for one day and then what, you know, it's like, it's, I feel like, the best people in bodybuilding are the people that stay in awesome shape year round and just kind of do photo shoots and they don't really compete. You know?
Yeah.
Like those are the best people to me because they always look like they're ready. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I also think the bodies on MMA fighters, you know, the physiques on the MMA fighters are outstanding. Like I'd rather look like that any day of the week than any sort of bodybuilder, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just even look like a dude, like Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor's got a sick physique. He's a little guy, but he's sick. You know, he's shredded. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of guys even like way more jacked than him that look amazing. Like a guy like a Tyrone Woodley, who's just like a genetic freak, you know? But, these MMA fighters that are just, they have awesome physiques. They look good. And I think that people like to call it, I think, functional. You know, I think everything's functional, or it's either functions or it doesn't. It's either functional or it's me, basically.
Yeah. Well, even so, thinking back to it, you know, I was probably 200, 210 pounds when I was a bodybuilder. And then, you know, going from that, being really strong, but then stepping onto a jiu-jitsu mat and being broken in half by somebody who was 130 pounds, that was a wake-up call.
Speaking of jiu-jitsu, I was actually on a movie set with my friend Fabricio Verdum, and he's one of the best jiu-jitsu guys in the world. But he was asking so many questions when we were on set. And I'm like, man, you ask a lot of questions. That's really good. And he said, I'm just a white belt. And that stuck with me for a long time. You know, so I actually say that sort of about everything when I'm stepping into somebody else's world, even in my own world. Like, I'm just a white belt. If you humble yourself to just not think that you know everything, you're going to be better for it. You're going to be able to learn a lot more. People that think they know it all, first of all, what you don't realize, if you think you know it all, everybody hates you behind your back.
Yeah.
And so if you know it all, don't tell people that you know it all because they hate you. And B, you're never going to learn or grow that way, you know?
Yeah, dude. I mean, that's the biggest thing I think that jiu-jitsu taught me was that it's good to be a white belt. It's good to be humble.
Where do you take jiu-jitsu? Who do you go train with?
I go a place called Pinnacle MMA out here in Redlands, and they've produced a few UFC fighters. The coach there, Jake Benny, he's just a great guy, fantastic individual, and they have a really awesome family atmosphere out here.
Yeah, I've been watching UFC since the first one way back in the day, 90s. Or whatever when it started. I remember that shit like it was yesterday.
Yeah, dude.
I loved all of it. I actually wrote a screenplay about the rise of the UFC when it first started. And I have a TV show. Like, I have a lot of scripted stuff that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. So I have a scripted television show that I just wrote. And hopefully if that goes, then I'll be able to make my MMA movie that I want to make. But I basically have an MMA story that's I wrote it a lot, like a while back, actually right after I did Bigger, Stronger, Faster. It's like Rocky in the world of MMA.
Mm-hmm.
It's a true life story about Pat Miletich, who is a badass and who's like, his story is so unbelievable. It's crazy. It's crazy that no one's ever told it before. you know.
Wow. Wow. What kind of stuff is going into it?
Yeah, it's called Runt because he was the runt of the family. Mm-hmm. You know, he came from a family of four brothers. He was always roughed up by them and beat up by them. And two of his brothers died. One of them died in an accident. Wow. One of them committed suicide. And the other one ended up in prison. And Pat's the only one that made it out. He ended up being UFC champion and, like, the best coach in the history of the UFC, you know, in the Hall of Fame and everything. Kind of before it all even started. But actually, through his story, like, his story is so weird because it just perfectly intersects with, like, when the UFC was starting. So it's, like, a really cool, you know, really cool story that sort of intersects with the UFC starting up and everything.
So one of the things I love about what you're saying here in your story is that, you know, you're constantly looking for something to push forward, meaning like you've got a project over here and you've got like two or three projects on the burner that you're working on. And I think that's so necessary.
I honestly think that like the world works like this. I think that Hollywood doesn't know a good thing when they see it. Mm-hmm. I think that somebody should be able to watch Bigger, Stronger, Faster and say, hey, this guy's got some real talent. Let's bring him in a room and grill him until we can figure out something else that we could do with him. They don't do enough of that kind of stuff because like I've had so many ideas for so many years. And what's going to happen now, I can actually feel it. I know when it's going to happen because I'm ready now. Mm-hmm. It's like I'll sell one thing and it'll sell everything you've ever written. You know, and like that's what happened with like Quentin Tarantino. Like he had... You know, for years he was like writing and writing and writing and nobody wanted to buy anything. And then somebody bought like Natural Born Killers and then everything he ever wrote sold, you know.
And that
happens with like all my friends. Like they've written scripts 10 years ago. They go pull them out of their closet and like, well, now somebody's interested because now you're somebody, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think especially bigger, stronger, faster. It had such an impact.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it, man.
You know, you literally changed a lot of people's minds on steroids and performance enhancement drugs.
I think the interesting thing is when you set out to do things like that is like you don't set out to do that. You were just like, this is my reality. I'm going to explain it to you. This is what I live in. This is what I deal with every day. Like, you know, and I'm going to explain it to you. And it just felt right when we were doing it. There wasn't any sort of like, you know, I hope this movie comes out and they legalize steroids. Like, it was nothing like that. It was just like, you know, I just want to let people know that this isn't as clear cut as they may think.
Well, yeah. And you know, here in the veteran community, we, like I said before, we've been dealing with a lot of issues as far as the military and testosterone replacement therapy. And we're to a point now where, a lot of these guys who are experiencing some of these issues from traumatic brain injury, they're not able to get okayed for HRT. But at the same time, and I have no problem with this at all, but you know, somebody can get the military to pay for their gender transition, which again, like I said, I have no problem with it. I just think that it's screwed up when the way we look at these things, because these guys are literally their lives, their jobs. They depend on their ability to perform, and if we're not giving them ability to do that, and we're disabling them at the same time through the job, then you know we're really putting them out to pasture, and that's horrible.
I think that's something that people don't really look at. They don't look at it like that. They look at testosterone as cheating as an issue in sports and has nothing to do with the health of the person, and it's not true. And until we change those perceptions, and hopefully things like Bigger, Stronger, Faster and prescription thugs and those kind of things do that, you know, we mask drugs rather than get people in shape beforehand so they don't get the disease. We just mask it when they get it, you know. I think that we're going to start building better bodies. And, you know, you can see it actually with the youth of America. If you look at in high schools and different things, like the younger kids that are coming into the gym nowadays, they're better equipped, they're in better shape, they're bigger, stronger, faster, you know?
Yeah.
And you can kind of see that in the next generation coming up. See a lot more people like in better shape when they're young, and hopefully they keep those habits throughout life. Hopefully more people get inspired by what's going on in the fitness world out there.
Definitely. You know, I want to be respectful of your time here. I just want to give you a chance. Is there any, what's the biggest, I guess, piece of advice you give to the guys out there who might be looking to become documentarians or might be thinking about trying to do something big in their lives?
Yeah, don't think about doing something big, and don't think that you have to do something big. Just do something because you want to do it. You know, do something with purpose and passion. Pick things that don't do anything that you don't want to do. But like, if you say I'm going to do a podcast, then commit to it and do it every week. If you say you're going to do, you know, just commit to things and do them. And I think that the number one thing with making documentaries is like, you know, I've gone through this a lot, and I still do. Well, I don't have this and I don't have that. And it's easy to make excuses, and don't make excuses, because when you make excuses, it's so easy to just put it off. But if you make yourself so you can't make excuses, like when you say, well, I don't really know how to do that. I don't know how to edit. Well, it's like, learn how to edit. You know, I don't know how to shoot. Learn how to shoot. And nowadays, if you have a story and you have access to that story and you really, really want to tell it, it's like, how bad do you really want to tell it? Like, pull out your iPhone and tell it, you know? There's ways to do everything. So there's also ways, you know, if you're a veteran, first of all, people are compassionate towards that. People want to help. And if you're a veteran, you have a good idea for a documentary or, you know, something like that, then, you know, start shooting some clips or start putting together some interviews or start, you know, compiling, like I said, an outline of something to give to somebody. But yeah, if somebody's serious about like making a documentary, I think that they have to do the work. Like I don't think I actually get offended by it is when people like reach out to me and they think that I'm going to tell their fucking story. Uh-huh. Like, yep. They're not going to tell your story, dude. Like, you know, they're like, hey man, I'm like a really good trainer and I'm in the fitness business and I'm a veteran. And I'm like, okay, well that doesn't mean that I should tell your story. Like you need to tell your story, and I'll tell them that. And they always go away at that point because they want me to do all the work. They don't want to do the work. Now, if I had somebody call up, like hit me up and say, I really need to tell my story. I need to get this out there no matter what. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. How do I tell my story? How do you tell my story? You know, somebody that actually wants to do it themselves and says like, look, you know, those are the people I look to help, the people that want to help themselves and the people that aren't looking for, you know, the easy way out. Like anybody can have an idea for a movie, but doing it's a totally different ballgame, you know?
And they'll gain more in the long run from that. I mean, you know, you're not going to learn anything from having everything given to you.
The thing is, you'll find out real quick that it's not just me, that people just aren't really that interested in telling your story. Like we attach on to things that affect us. So unless your story really affected me, which it could, but, and you know, it's always rare to me that every time somebody's ever come to me with an idea, it's always been better suited that person pursue that idea than me, because it's always more fitted towards what they're trying to accomplish in life and not what I'm trying to accomplish in life. So that's why I always like tell people like, hey, like people come up to me like, dude, you know what you should do? You should do a documentary on PTSD. And I'm like, no, you should do it because you're obviously interested in it. That's why you're telling me to do it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's why I tell people, like, I feel like they're interested in it. They should be looking to pursue it.
Definitely. Definitely. And I imagine, like, walking around a place like Venice and being recognized, you probably have a bunch of people come up to you and say,
you know, like I actually love that. I love talking to people and stuff like that. Yeah, if people try to pitch me stuff and things like, usually the problem is people aren't any good. They don't know how to pitch you. They don't know how to captivate you. They don't know how to hold your attention, and they're boring. Mm-hmm. And they're just as boring on paper. So when they hand you that paper, it's going to be the same thing. So like, if you're going to come up to me and like pitch me something, you better have like a couple sentences that knock my socks off. Right. Where I'm like, holy shit, that's fucking awesome. You know, and there are things that hit me like that. There are things that I think like that, like, whoa, that guy just explained that so well. You know what I mean? And I'll think about it for days and days and I'll call that person, but it's the person that comes up and I said, well, what's it about? And they stutter because they don't know, and they're not really sure what it's about. And it's like, why would I be interested in that? You didn't put the work in. I'm always just interested in people that have done the work and people willing to do the work, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, no bums around here.
No, man.
And you can ask my brother about that. We don't, no bums around our family.
Yeah. It seems like you guys got instilled a really strong work ethic from when you were young. And I admire the fact that you include your family in your documentaries and I come from an East Coast Italian, family as well. And reminded me a whole lot of that. And my mom worked 3 jobs growing up. That's the biggest thing that's ever affected me in my life. Do you feel like your parents, really instilled that work ethic into you?
My parents are 2 of the most awesome people on the face of the planet. And it's hard to not really give them all the credit for all of this. You know, I don't know really how they did it. They were just good people, you know, and they were, for some reason, my parents, they're always like, I don't know how this happened, but like our kids never grew up and wanted to be normal or average. Our kids wanted to be like extraordinary, you know, mm-hmm. They wanted to be professional wrestlers and we wanted to all play in the NFL, but none of us were that tall, yeah. You know, and all, you know, just we didn't have the goals of other kids. And some people think that's weird and other people think that's awesome. So it just matters where you fall, but we didn't want to be doctors and lawyers or firefighters and policemen. We wanted to be, you know, pro wrestlers and documentary filmmakers and whatever, you know, like, so, and my, you know, my journey's not complete. My journey, started out, I went to USC to make films and I haven't got to make films in the medium that I want to make films in the medium I think that I'm best suited to make films, which is scripted stuff. And so I'm right now pitching a TV show. Like I said, I have a movie coming up that I want to do. So I have other things that I want to do that are goals for me. It's not just all about making documentaries. I actually feel like the other stuff is going to be, it's going to get crazier when we get to play with some toys, you know?
Well, I definitely hope you do feel good about the impact you have had in the work that you are doing.
It always feels good, but I just feel like you're just like doing, you know, you do something and it's over and you move on. You do something, it's over, yep. And you move on. You just keep putting points on the scoreboard. You keep stacking up chips, you know, because at the end of the day, the only thing you'll ever have is your legacy and what you leave behind. And if you're not, you know, what are you leaving behind? Like, I didn't do shit, yeah, with my life. Yeah, that's a great legacy to leave behind. Like, I'm not into that, you know.
Yeah.
I gotta leave something behind that's cool.
Exactly.
Something that people can be proud of. And even if that's just getting up and going to work every day or serving your country, those are noble things to be very proud of. Even just taking care of your own family, doing something very simple, as long as you're fulfilled as a human being, and that fulfillment usually comes from having connections with family and friends. It usually doesn't come out of fame and fortune. And so I like to always put that in perspective for a lot of people. I actually get along a lot better with common people than I do with anybody that's famous or anybody that's in the film industry or anything. I get along best with your group, like veterans and mm-hmm. You know, people of that nature. I couldn't serve in the military because I have, right now I have 2 fake hips, but I've always had arthritis since I was young. And I've always had issues, health issues. And so I could never enlist in the military. I'm not saying that I was definitely gonna or anything, but it is something that definitely had crossed my mind. I just was never able to. So I always just say, like, whatever I can do to help veterans, you know, I want to do. And that's a group I always get along with.
And seriously, we thank you for it.
I think probably because of the work ethic too, you know, yeah. Like veterans are ass kickers. So you're like, okay. They know what's up. That military lifestyle, like it's that, like I'm into that too. You know, I'm into structure and purpose and doing, getting things done, you know?
Well, that's what I really like about this is working with veterans and having a company that caters to veterans. Cause I've catered to both, you know, I was in the fitness/bodybuilding world for a while and in the vet, you know, working with veterans, having a veteran, clothing company. And, you know, what I love about this population is that, one, they're so supportive, and so supportive of people from their community and succeeding.
Sure.
And 2, you really hear like a real complaint. You know, a lot of these guys are out there, they're busting their butts. They're trying to make it in the civilian world and they don't complain about much. And I think that's so important. If civilians can take anything away from the veteran population and from the military, it's that idea of getting things done without complaining, feeling fortunate for what you have.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think people can complain. Yeah. There's a ton of people that complain all day long. So, you know, it's good to have a group that doesn't.
Well, Chris, dude, I want to thank you so much for coming on here today. You know, for those of you guys who don't know, you know, I reached out to Chris and Chris was just gracious in getting right back to me because he heard that this was a veteran-oriented podcast. And he wanted to do everything he could to bring this information to all of you. And, you know, Chris, one, thank you for your work. Thank you for bringing these issues to light of day. And it's absolutely amazing. And for all of you.
I appreciate it. I just wanted to say thank you guys to be, you know, for what you guys do. And it's important for all of us to support, you know, each other.
Thank you, Chris. And that was Chris Bell from Bigger, Stronger, Faster, and Prescription Thugs, dropping a whole lot of awesome gems for all of you. I want to thank you all for listening to this podcast. And wherever you are, whatever you're doing, get out there and live your best life. This is Chris, out.